Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals the hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be
goodness. There is a Terua horn. Thank you for adding the Terua call. It is delightful to be able to coordinate today's tonight's program, really, with the festival, the feast of Terua. I was talking with Kirk earlier today about the fact that we have been engaged in Terua, you know, 6 days a week for every year for the past 10 to 15 years. So Terua is really part of our nature. It is the nature of, I think, everyone who is associated with the covenant. We're here to constantly convey two messages. One is that a warning that human institutions, whether they be government, religious, military, such institutions are counterproductive. We ought not trust them. We ought not rely on them. We ought to disassociate ourselves from them to the greatest degree possible. That they have nothing to do with God, and God will not tolerate any loyalty to those institutions in his home and family. And second, that Yahweh has at great personal cost and in great detail laid out a very specific path from our troubled world to his perfect realm, and that we can meet with him through the seven Moed Mikre, of which today is the fifth of seven, and by way of his Berith Covenant. So that is the purpose of this day, and it's something, Kirk, we talked about, we have really devoted ourselves to. This is
pretty much,
this day
yeah.
is business as usual. It's what we do. And being part of the covenant, it's what we are literally compelled to do. And I don't mean compelled in a command.
Not a force.
It's
desire.
By volition, by desire. It's like when you have children, you feel compelled to care for them. In that sense, it's a loving choice. Of best job in the world, really, is to Terua. And so, what we decided we would do today on the observations program was to talk about the timing of Terua. I think everyone that's listening tonight, everyone in the covenant, has a firm grasp of what Terua represents, which is, as I've stated, a warning to the world that their trust and faith and religion and politics and their military is misguided and counterproductive, separating them from God, and that God is a very specific path that he has laid out through his Torah for us to engage in a relationship with him and to benefit from everything he has to offer. That's the purpose of Terua, Now, there is a specific observation, a specific celebration of Teruah, where Yahweh honors a promise. And the promise is to harvest his children, to bring his children home, and to spare his children from the worst part of the time of Jacob's, of Yisrael's troubles, particularly the last 3.5 years of what we call the tribulation, the last 3.5 years before he returns. So he's going to keep us away from everything following the strike of the asteroid Apophis, volcanic, mountain, Carne Viejo, in all likelihood, cascading in an avalanche into the Atlantic Ocean, causing tidal waves and the nuclear holocaust that follows, where a third of the Earth becomes uninhabitable. He's going to keep us out of that. There's only, my understanding is really only going to be a couple of representatives, a couple of human representatives, and some Moloch that are going to be around during that that last 3.5 years. You're not going to find Yahweh anywhere near this planet. And we talked about this in our last program. If it were not for the promises that Yahweh made to Abraham, he wouldn't be coming back. So he has distanced himself from the planet, and we're going to have the two witnesses, likely Elijah and Enoch, that are going to be testifying on behalf of Yahweh, and at the same time condemning the demonic influences of the Torahless One, the militarism of man, the political nature of man, the religious nature of man. They'll be condemning that while underscoring the value of Yahweh's Torah, teaching his guidance. And at the same time, there will be at least a Moloch, if not more than one, that will be engaged holding up the tablets of stone when the Sunday law is established, as it was by Theodosius in Rome, and what became the Roman Catholic Church, where they made Christianity not only the only religion, but you were penalty for not observing Christianity became death. That's the same thing that's going to be established. The model for the model or prototype of the Torahless One, the Antichrist, is Paul. So you're going to see a forced observation of likely Christmas, Easter, and Sunday worship. All during that period of time. And over the only ones that will be here will be kept out of that last part. But the question is, when will this harvest occur? It did not occur this Teruah. I don't think there's even a remote chance that it's going to occur prior to 2026. And I think that there's a possibility it could occur as late as 2027 and 2028. And the reason for that is the timing of this harvest as it is presented in Yeshayah 17. Mm-hmm. So, Kirk, here's what we reviewed this morning. We'll go over it quickly now so we can make progress into the parts we didn't cover. This is a prophetic pronouncement regarding Damascus. Behold, Damascus is revolting and corrupt and will be removed from inhabited cities. It is degenerate and unrestrained and shall be abolished. And she shall totally and actually become a twisted and tangled heap of rubble. Now, big time bold proclamation there, because as we've talked about, Damascus is the longest continually inhabited city in the world. So to predict that it's not only going to be revolting and corrupt, which it most certainly is, today among the most degenerate and unrestrained places on earth, it wasn't even possible for a place to a city to become a twisted, entangled heap of rubble until rebar. Mm-hmm. And something you mentioned earlier today, but beyond that, it was unfathomable that that's what people could do to a city. Until we saw what the jihadists and the governments acting on behalf of one side or the other did to Homs and Aleppo and Fallujah and Mosul, it would have been essentially impossible to imagine a city in Syria, for example, left, particularly Damascus, left as a twisted and tangled heap of rubble. Abandoned and forsaken, estranged, deserted, and destroyed, damned will be the inhabited regions and populated cities of Aror, the outcasts in Jordan and Lebanon. Now, the reason, Kirk, you know this now, the reason that Jordan and Lebanon are going to be devoid of people other than the jihadists, what is the reason for that?
Well, because the jihadists will go there, the ones that have nothing more to fight for. They no one else to fight. They will move down there, obviously, because they want to go to Israel and destroy Israel.
Yeah, once they destroy Damascus, they have no desire to control or rule Damascus. Right. No interest in that at all. It does suggest, though, that the Sunnis will prevail in the Sunni-Shia civil war that's going about throughout the Islamic world. And it's inevitable, of course, that the Sunnis prevail because they outnumber the Shia by, 5-1, maybe 6-1,
yeah.
And they outgun them 25-1. So they're going to prevail. And they have no interest in Damascus. They only try to occupy cities like Mosul, for example, where the preponderance of the people are Sunnis. They would have no desire whatsoever to occupy Damascus, so they're going to leave Damascus. And so the Sunnis have to go someplace, and the Shia have to go someplace, because the Shia will be ousted. And the Shia presence in Damascus, of course, is Hezbollah. That's the Hezbollah's headquarters. So where do you think Hezbollah is going to go when they lose control of Damascus?
Straight down south, Lebanon on down.
Lebanon, yeah, they're going to Lebanon, actually west, but they're going to Lebanon. And the Sunnis, what Sunni country are they likely to go to?
It has to be
Jordan,
I'm sorry.
Jordan. That's why Jordan and Lebanon are listed here. That is the inevitable consequence of the fall of Damascus. And God's just laid it out. He laid this out 2,700 years ago. Until we understood that a war would be started by the United States to pit Shia against Sunni, and that the battleground would be Damascus, and that the Sunnis would prevail because they have 25 times more Western weaponry than do the Shias, and that the Shias, we know, are embedded in Lebanon, and it's all Sunnis in Jordan, we'd never be able to put these pieces together. This understanding, the specificity of this, requires a considerable education.
Yeah. Well, I remember us talking where we couldn't figure out how could it even last this long.
Correct.
When Russia came in and said to Obama, no, you're not.
And you're not. Yeah, you're not going to take out Assad now. We're not going to destroy Damascus now. It will be destroyed, but it'll be destroyed in all likelihood around 2026. You know, it could be a little before that. It could be 2025, but in around that period of time. And then it says that, for there will be roaming animals fighting in militant militias, failing miserably, but then there was no one to terrorize. There's two aspects of this that are also just so detailed. The jihadists are animals. They kidnap and rape little girls. They march on anybody who doesn't capitulate to them in the name of their goddamn religion and crucify them, cut off their heads gleefully while reading from their demonic Quran. If there ever was a group of animals, you know, slicing people's throats, you know, killing parents in front of their children, teaching children to be murderers, raping little girls, Now, the militant militias of jihadists are roaming animals. And let's face it, they're failing miserably. The Islamic State is failing. Hezbollah is failing. There has never been a successful Islamic militia. Now, if you were to list all manner of things that one could be proud of that would list as an accomplishment, there is no jihadist Islamic group that has ever done any of them. They're destructive.
Mm-hmm.
They're deadly. They fail miserably. It's just that they're so enamored with their godforsaken religion, they continue to fail miserably.
Did you read this week where they discovered that it was revealed that the Pentagon funneled $2.2 billion in arms to ISIS?
Mm-hmm.
Trump had said, we won't give any, we will, he stopped CIA from doing it. But
yeah.
The Pentagon itself, we armed the people. If we didn't arm them, they couldn't keep fighting. God, so we're co-conspirators.
You know, and Syria. And that's what God's talking about here, what's going on in Syria.
Yeah.
Syria has got to be the biggest screw-up in the history of humankind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is no way to differentiate the Islamic State from al-Nusra, which was the original and largest jihadist group there, from the quote-unquote Free Syrian Army. There, every Sunni Islamic terrorist group is the same.
Yeah.
And so if you were funneling weapons, which is America's, you know, seems to be the thing that we do the most, is funnel weapons. It's a crime, by the way, if anybody else does it, but America does it. But if you were to funnel weapons to those fighting Assad, because your goal is to depose Assad, then your weapons are going to go to the Islamic State. That's just the way it is. You know, if you were to try to give them to the Free Syrian Army, they're going to hand them to the Islamic State unless they be killed.
Sure.
So there's no way to prevent it. But the reason it's such a screw-up is that the United States' primary ally there are the Kurds. And yet we have a NATO member who's involved in all this, Turkey,
mm-hmm.
who is using American weapons to bomb the Kurds. So the Turks are using American weapons to bomb the Kurds while America is providing the Kurds with weapons to attack the Islamic State.
Yeah.
The United States is providing weapons to the Sunni militias, of which the dominant Sunni militia is the Islamic State, because we want to do away with Assad. But Russia is trying to protect Assad, because Assad is a client of Russia, but also because they know that the alternative to Iran is far worse than Assad.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to imagine a more volatile situation. The other day, the United States was accused by Russia of bombing Russian installations in Syria. Are we dead set against dead set in favor of starting World War III? China and Russia allied with Iran, because we've isolated Iran, and Iran controls access to the Caspian Sea natural gas reserves, of which both Russia and China have invested between $15 and $20 billion of their gross domestic product building pipelines to sell that oil and gas. And so they're in bed with Iran, and that's never going to change. And Iran has now, as a client state, Syria, only because the United States invaded Iraq, because the Baathist Alliance previously was Assad's defense mechanism. But now that we invaded Iraq, it's It's the mullahs in Tehran. We just made an absolute mess of things. And we're here in this quagmire that America has created, and we're arming both sides and fighting against, really, China and Russia. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know how you could create a worse scenario. God is describing that scenario. That's what he is doing in this prophecy. And what's going to be left? A twisted heap of rubble. Abandoned and forsaken will be the inhabited regions and populated. You know, God didn't say everybody there is going to get killed. No. Why? Because for the conditions to exist, that Jews can't live any place other than Israel, then millions of Muslims had to migrate out of the Middle East. And America's invasion of Iraq is what caused that. We precipitated that. And so the reason there'll be no one there for them to kill is that they're fleeing by the millions into Europe, causing Europe to be so anti-Semitic that Jews are having to migrate out of Europe.
The rabbis are saying move to Israel.
Move to Israel. And by the way, that's the only place where God can protect a Jew. He's not going to protect all of them.
Mm-hmm.
But the only place he'll protect any of them is in Israel. Because he doesn't know them individually because they don't know him. So there are these roaming animals fighting in militant militias, failing miserably. It's a perfect depiction of what we're witnessing. And then after the fall of Damascus, they're going to go to Jordan and Lebanon. But there'll be no one to terrorize. Why? Because you know, Angela Merkel and her like have opened the gates of Europe.
Oh, they've got rid of them, you know. They're giving them away to escape, right? Yeah, of course.
So the fortified place and defensive structures will cease to exist on account of Ephraim, the northern kingdom, along with the government out of Damascus, including a remnant of Syria and Assyria, from being similarly vehement and burdensome, onerous, dim-witted, and enraged. Boy, if there's ever an apt depiction of Muslims, it would be fanatical and onerous, dim-witted and enraged. And it's an absolutely perfect depiction of Islam. They're arrogant. They're violent. They are fanatical. And you have to be stupid to be a Muslim. I mean, it's the ultimate dim-witted religion that produces enraged individuals. So Syria itself is going to fall, along with Damascus, is what is being said here. The children of Yisrael, those individuals who engage and endure with God, shall actually continue to exist. This is we talked about this at length earlier today, Kirk.
Yes,
I mean, it's a bold prophecy to say that the longest continuing inhabited city in the world is going to become a heap of ruins. That's a bold prophecy. It's a bold prophecy to say that it's going to happen at the hands of militant militias who act like animals. It is another thing to say that after they destroy Damascus and Syria falls, that they're going to head to Lebanon and Jordan. But it's another thing altogether to say that Israel will continue to exist. Because this was written 2,700 years ago, and Israel was on the cusp of being destroyed by the Assyrians.
Of them, yeah.
Yeah, and then later, Yehuda would be destroyed by Babylon at 500 BCE, and then by Rome, not once, but twice.
Mm-hmm.
And it ceased to be a country from 135 all the way through 1948. So how does Israel continue to exist if it doesn't exist? Well, it had to be reconstituted as a country. And that's an unbelievably bold prediction because it's never happened before.
Name me another country that didn't exist for that long and then came back and consisted of the same people. The Palestinian people don't count because they ain't really Palestinians.
No. Correct. No, well, Palestinians are gone. I don't think you can name a single country that ceased to exist for a century that was reconstituted. I don't think you can name one for a century, much less for 19 centuries. So that's another So the lead up to this says you can darn well trust the inspiration behind this prophecy, because the agent behind this prophecy clearly had access to future history. They could see what we are witnessing today and reported that back in time 2,700 years ago. So that takes us to 17:3. Now let's move on. And it will actually come to pass in that day that the size of Jacob is Israel, shall be decreased to the point of no longer being sustainable or viable. And the fattest, best protected, most important place, the waist or midsection of Yisrael, his body, shall be leaned, shall be made thin, shrinking in size. Now, this is again I talked about, I don't know how many of you watch the NFL channels prior to the game, but their highlight of their morning show is called Bold Predictions. Well, this is a stunningly bold prediction. This says that after Damascus falls, after Syria falls, after the jihadists migrate to Jordan and Lebanon, mm-hmm. that the way that the world reacts, because Israel's not going to fit itself, the way the world reacts to them staging themselves in these two places is to capitulate to them and to give them what we know now as the West Bank, which is parts of Judea and mostly Samaria, mm-hmm. the eastern shore of it's the west side of the Jordan River.
Land for peace.
East Israel, western side of the Jordan River. Now, what that says, again, it affirms that Israel has to exist during the last days after the fall of Damascus, but that the world is going to repeat Neville Chamberlain's mistake. The world is going to see these jihadists aggregated in Jordan and Lebanon after destroying Damascus and say, you know, we can't afford any more refugees. We were unable to stop this battle. We can't supply them with more weapons and hoping that they just obliterate each other. Everything we have done has backfired. And now what they want is to destroy Israel. So the way we can achieve peace is the two-state solution. We will impose the two-state solution. In a modern world, we as a world will isolate Israel, and we will tell Israel, you give them the West Bank, and you give it to them now. Just like Neville Chamberlain. Last time mm-hmm. I checked, the high ground in Czechoslovakia was not part of the UK. He sacrificed another nation's land to appease the Nazis. And the closest thing to Nazis today are Muslims. Mm-hmm. They're all fascist governments. Yeah. And so the world is going to say, wait a second, we got to stop this. Because they won't be content with Israel. They'll just continue. And so we've got to get them so they don't terrorize us anymore and start attacking us for our support of Israel. The answer is, rather than being terrorized for our support of Israel, we'll capitulate and give them Israel. But more than that, it tells us that Israel can be thinned at the waist. Well, the waist of Israel is comprised of three areas. Gaza. That's already been given to them. Yeah. The West Bank, that's what's going to be capitulated. And there's a 7-mile strip in between where 70% of Israel's population lives. So this prophecy says it will be decreased to the point it's no longer sustainable and viable. The moment Israel capitulates the West Bank, it is no longer viable as a nation. It's impossible to defend, particularly against 1.5 million Islamic jihadists who would prefer to die killing Jews than to live alongside them. And it takes into effect 2,700 years ago that Israel would be positioned such that after giving away Gaza, in the last days they would be forced to capitulate the West Bank, which would achieve the specific nature of this prophecy. So it actually foresaw the West Bank being viewed as occupied territory that could be capitulated in the name of peace. That is extraordinarily specific. Now, the reason we would time this to the beginning of the tribulation is Daniel provides us with a narrative of this time. And what Daniel says is that a treaty will be reaffirmed with many. And so that treaty that will be reaffirmed with many is likely the UN resolutions that not only establish the state of Israel, but that specifically carve Israel up such that the West Bank is still considered occupied territory. And so since we know that that is an event that Daniel predicts happens, and that event is coterminous with the arrival of the Torahless One, known to Christians as the Antichrist. And we have assumed that, based upon the narrative in Daniel, I think it's a reasonable interpretation, that this treaty being affirmed with many, which is likely this one we're discussing right now, where Israel is compelled to give up the West Bank, pity the nation that the way is becoming unsustainable, that is the initial act of the beginning of the seven-year time of Jacob's trouble, and that it is the world at large that is forcing Israel to do this.
Yeah, it has to be the UN, because it has to be the only powers that be, the big major powers, would have to be the ones that stamp of approval on it, because you could have 100, you'd have 50 countries say, we're going to do this, and they could say no. What would they do?
I think that under those circumstances, the circumstances that Yahweh has just laid out, which is future history, so it's going to happen that way, I don't think that Israel will receive a single supportive vote.
Probably not. I can't imagine who would be brave enough, who would stand up for them. I wonder who will.
Yes. Yeah, it actually doesn't take any courage at all, because you're standing with God if you stand up
for
them.
Yeah, that's true.
So that actually takes no courage. It's quite to the point of being foolhardy, particularly at this time, to vote against Israel. But be that as it may. So that is the timing of this. So what is the next statement that Yahweh makes? What does he want to tell us now? So that means that Israel is no longer sustainable as a nation. Things are going to get really bad at this point. So what does God do?
When he takes us out?
Then, this is the next word, wah, then, it shall be like the gathering in and receiving, kaf, of a harvest, katsir. We're told specifically that Teruah is a harvest. And then it shall be like the gathering in and receiving of a harvest of standing grain. Come on, standing grain, that which is upright, has the ability to stand and rise from kum, to affirm, to validate, to establish, to stand upright.
So kumbaya.
Kumbaya. So then it shall be like ka, similar to the gathering in and receiving, bringing together, collecting, assembling, and removing, in gathering and withdrawing of a harvest katsir, the reaping of the fruit from katsar. To remove, particularly at a vexing time of grief. Come on, the standing grain. That's what's going to happen. So what that tells us is that this harvest associated with Teruah follows the fall of Damascus, follows the fall of Syria, follows the jihadists acting like animals, and running amok in Jordan and Lebanon, follows another mass migration of people out of the Islamic world, making the world impossible for a Jew to survive. That after all of that, and then the world capitulates, forcing Israel to give up what's called the West Bank, bending the nations away so that it waste is no longer sustainable, then the harvest occurs. So you wonder when the harvest is occurring. Is Teruah, could Teruah be fulfilled today?
It's highly unlikely.
No, the answer is absolutely not. The answer is
there would be no virtue for Yahweh doing that.
Absolutely not. It can't be. Why? Damascus still stands.
Because we're here for a reason.
Syria is still a country. Why?
The jihadists haven't
pushed the masses out of Lebanon and Jordan yet. Why? Because Israel hasn't been forced to capitulate the West Bank. Until all of those things happen, the Teruah harvest cannot happen. So all those things, they aren't going to happen by this time next year.
No.
Is it technically possible? I guess, yeah, but it ain't going to happen by next year. Mm-hmm. And if, indeed, this treaty, which is affirmed by many, which is what we're talking about here in terms of thinning of Israel, the West Bank, if that, in fact, is coterminous with the arrival of the Torahless one known as the Antichrist and the beginning of Jacob's trouble, the seven-year tribulation, then this harvest occurs during the early part of the tribulation before things get really bad.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes perfect sense. It is in Yahweh's interest. It is in our interest. It is in humankind's interest that we stay here as long as absolutely possible. But no father is going to subject his children to what follows this, because what follows this is Israel, while it continues to exist, just gets pummeled. And the world engages in the Magog War. And that's followed by a nuclear holocaust. And then the world's at war. And then that's followed by the strike of POFUS. I talked a little bit today.
Share with everybody what you were talking about on that show.
I was sent this by Chuck, but I'm not sure. And if I credited the wrong person, I'm sorry. But I was sent a link to a video, and I hate to watch videos. I hate to watch videos because when you have a talking head, you usually just get mumbo jumbo. This video had, and I forgot the guy's name, but he is a renowned African-American scientist and astronomer. Very well-spoken. He's on a gazillion Science Channel and Discovery Channel programs where they're actually talking about astronomy. And he did a lecture on Apophis. Apophis, I think is how he called it. And what he says is, I think it's going to strike the Earth. And he describes the effects of it. He describes that where it's likely to hit and the size of the tsunami that it's going to create and what it's going to wipe out. And this thing, Apophis is the size of the Rose Bowl, the football stadium. It's big and it's dense. And it's going to be catastrophic. And so he described it. Now, in his view, he says, it's going to come so close to the Earth in 2029. He told the date, Friday the 13th of 2029, that it's going to go through what's called through a keyhole, and then it's going to actually strike the Earth 7 years later. He hasn't read the Torah, the Prophets and Psalms.
Yah's version.
Yeah, and Yah's version. And doesn't know that it's going to be nudged by one of the billions upon billions of asteroids, comets, meteors, and the like debris out there in our solar system, and it's going to strike the Earth in 2029. And he says the reason it's named Apophis, is because this is the first time that we as scientists have discovered an asteroid that is on a collision course with Earth and that it's going to be deadly. So we named it after the Egyptian god of death and darkness,
mm-hmm.
because that's the consequence of this asteroid.
Yeah.
And so here's a renowned scientist just laying it all on the line. Now, he didn't know that you named it Apophis because God said that you're going to name it that 2,000 years ago. You know, I was watching a program called Salvation. It was about the impending asteroid strike on Earth, and the President of the United States did this coded speech, and she referenced the passage that the King James translates, the misrepresents the name of this rather than Apophis, and it misrepresents the name of Wormwood. Yeah, as Wormwood. As Wormwood. And you just go, God, people just don't think. You know, if people actually knew what was written there, they would tie it in and know what's going to occur. Anyway, God's going to keep us out of that because he loves us. And so that means that this harvest will absolutely occur prior to the end of 2028, because the Teruah harvest always occurs on Teruah, which is always the seventh month of the of Yah's calendar, which is always in late September or early October on our calendar. And April is early in the year, so it cannot be in 2029. It must be in 2028 or 2027, or it could be in 2026. But if it's in 2026, this treaty that is reaffirmed by many that thins Israel of the waste has to occur prior to it happening. Damascus has to fall prior to it. So we will know. We will know for certain what Teruah we will be harvesting. And there's no reason to speculate. And that's the reason, really, I wanted to go into. Since we've studied, we're all living through, and we talked about this also, Kirk, today.
Yes,
if you're a newbie in the covenant family, then you should be engaged in your own personal Teruah, which means that you're studying human institutions and coming to know why they are corrupt and counterproductive, and you're studying Yahweh's words to understand what he's offering and why he's offering it.
Mm-hmm.
And you're preparing yourself to effectively have an outgoing Teruah, which is what we're doing today.
Yeah.
So that is what we're engaged in, and we're going to continue it as a family right up to the time that we're harvested, and that time appears to be right after, that time will be right after Israel is sent to the waste.
Yeah.
So we are in a position to know when this is going to occur. I suspect that is 2026, 2027 is the most likely time, but no reason to speculate. We will know. It's
mm-hmm.
for certain.
Now, this the dominoes fall, and there it is.
Yeah, I mean, he's laid it out. This is what must happen. So there should be no speculation about anything.
How Yahweh does that for
these are very specific sets of events. Then he says, and his sacrificial lamb, his Zeruah, his strong arm and power, his might, he who shoulders our burden from Zara, he who sows the seeds which produce offspring, will collect and harvest the first fruits. Oh my goodness. Whether you want to translate Zeruah as his strong arm, and so that it's Yahweh's arm symbolically that is harvesting us. That's fine. I don't have a problem with that. And I look at the sacrificial lamb, which is the diminished manifestation of Yahweh, as being so diminished, he would represent less than even the arm and hand of God. So the strong arm of Yahweh is certainly a fine translation here. So you can have it. I wouldn't argue with anybody who wants to translate Zeroah, sacrificial lamb, as that's how it's used in the Torah. When Zeroah is presented in the Torah, it is the sacrificial lamb. But you can also render it the strong arm and power of Yahweh. Will collect and harvest. That zir, or kat zir, the first fruits. The reason I said, oh my, is if there is a better way to describe the children of the covenant than first fruits, I don't know what it is. You know, Bakurim, which is from Bakar. Firstborn child. And Bakurim is the plural, so it's firstborn children. And Yahweh uses the metaphor of standing grain because you can separate the grain from the chaff.
Chaff is much more
abundant than is the grain, which is useful. And so it's a good, really, metaphor of the standing grain. It stands upright. The kernel is valuable. The rest of it is blown away as chaff. And so he uses that metaphor. That metaphor is also incumbent upon Pesach because the timing of Pesach is Abib, when the barley kernel is standing, still moist and growing and receptive in the ear. So standing grain, you look at his house, his home for the family on Moriah, and it was built on a threshing floor. What does a threshing floor do? Separates the valuable grain from the chaff. So when he's speaking of that harvest of standing grain, and he calls us the first fruits, you know, Pesach, Masa, Bakurim. You are made immortal, perfected, and then adopted as firstborn children. The purpose of the covenant is to adopt us into Yahweh's family. We are His first fruits.
And there again, what would be the purpose of enlightening us, and empowering us if He wasn't going to keep us around to help Him? He likes to work with people.
He does. So I expect that He will be using His first fruits here on earth, the covenant's children, right up to the very moment that he uses His strong arm to collect us.
Yeah.
He likes working through people. We'll be here to work with Him. We're happy to do so, thrilled to do so. Best job in the world.
He's promised to protect you the whole way. So,
and he's got nothing
to lose and everything to gain.
Right. Yeah, He's promised to protect us, so we have nothing to lose. He enriches us and empowers us and enlightens us and just totally enriching our lives every step of the way. The more we study Him, the more joyous the whole experience is. So, just marvelous. Yeah, you're right. He's going to continue to use His children until using His children puts His children in harm's way. And could Yahweh protect us through a nuclear holocaust? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Could He protect us through the impact of Apophis? Yes. Could He protect us through the Magog War? Yes. But do you think Yahweh wants His children to witness an assault on Israel that is as gruesome as the Islamic State's assault was on Iraq and Syria, where they butchered by either crucifying or by cutting the throats of all those who opposed them, even those who wouldn't align with them, and then they kidnapped little girls and turned them into sex slaves? Do you think Yahweh wants us to watch that? You know, it's one thing for, you know, to do it out of sight to people that we do not know, but to do it to God's chosen people?
Yeah.
Do you think He wants us as His adopted children to watch that? No.
I don't want a mental scar like that.
No. He doesn't want us to. You know, Yahweh does not want his children to witness a nuclear holocaust either. So, he's going to collect his first fruits, and it shall be as a gleaning. Now, why do you think he's talked about the harvest twice, and then he uses the term gleaning, lakot? Do you guys have any idea why lakot was chosen?
Well, other than secondary.
Lakot is a small secondary harvest. Now, it's rendered for two reasons. One is Yahweh has harvested, collected into his home, everyone who has become part of the covenant and has since passed away in their mortal existence. And so Dodus and Moshe and Noach and Abraham and Yishak and Yaakov and Yosef, there's so many. They're Samuel. They're already with him. So this is a secondary harvest, and it's a small harvest. Not going to be a lot of us. There is a, and by the way, a secondary harvest doesn't always mean that it has to be second in order. It just means this is, a gleaning is a small harvest. There's going to be a big harvest. Relative eggs. Yeah, 2033. So this is a gleaning of ears of grain. Again, the same symbolism. In the valley of Raphaim. Raphaim is souls of the deceased. From Rapha, defects which have been healed by a physician, restoring the impaired to health. I kind of like being called a defective.
Very accurate.
Restored by the ultimate physician to health.
Yes.
So
okay.
The valley
yeah,
of
like
the of defects who have been restored. That's marvelous.
Very accurate.
He's got a sense of humor. What were you going to say, JB?
I said, I'm okay with this.
Yeah.
You can call me that anytime.
Yeah, you know, when I study Yahweh's word, in fact, I'm in a section right now which is all symbolism, and I'm already slugging through it. I don't even mind. I know it's a pejorative in our society, but if you wanted to call me a retard, I'm just fine with it. By comparison of the mind of the individual whose words I'm studying, I am defective in my thinking. Even if you read, you know, Dode's lyrics, you know, I'm defective in my thinking. And in him, and likely this is lowercase him, as in Jacob, therefore in Israel, there will be those who leave, gleanings, as in going around a olive tree. Two or three ripe olives on the top branch, four or five on the fruitful branches which have been cut away, prophetically declares Yahweh, God of Israel. Now, there is a possibility here, and I'm not certain of it, but let me at least throw this out for a thought. The first fruit harvest is all of those of us who became part of the covenant family, 99.99% of whom live outside of Israel. Israeli Jews aren't ready for this message. They've way too much indoctrination working against them. They're just not ready for this message. But what it sounds like is that after the first fruits, the covenant family, are harvested, there's going to be, it could be two or three. You know, it's not a lot going here. I mean, we're talking about two or three ripe olives in the top, four or five on the fruitful branches which have been cut away. So, you know, you could have two or three, more than two or three, but to be, that's give you a relative number,
a feel,
a comparison number, a feel. Ripe olives on the top of branch. Now, the branch is Dode. Dode is the branch. So, we're talking about now Yahudim. And so there's going to be two or three Yehudim from the branch. And then it says four or five of the fruitful branches which have been cut away. Cut away branches, what I think that represents is Yehudim, Jews, who are living outside of Israel. So either as part of this gleaning or as immediately following it, after harvesting the first fruits of covenant children, there are going to be some Israelites, and particularly Yehudim, because the branch represents those, who are going to be harvested. It's just a really, really small number.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think he's repeating himself here, which would be fine, because that's the nature of Hebrew poetry. I don't think he's repeating himself here. I think he's making a distinction. First fruits in general, which are firstborn children, which is a concept that is completely and totally irrespective of race. It does not indicate if we are... Yeah, we can be Goyim or Yisraelite. It makes no difference on the first fruits. But then he's going to the branch. And the branch represents Dod and Yaudem. And he's also gone to olives at this point. So he's gone from standing grain, to use his next favorite. I mean, he's got three favorite fruits. The fruit of the barley, the standing grain. The olive, which is the next here. And, of course, the grape. And so now the olive. The olive is the... longest living tree in Israel, the most established tree in Israel, is about the only tree that existed in Israel when the country was reestablished, reconstituted as Israel. And it produces a fruit that creates olive oil, which was used to light the lamps, particularly the menorah, used for healing, used for anointing in the sense of calling out someone who is prepared to serve. And as a source of light, it represents, and as a source of healing, because it was put on wounds, it represents the purpose of the set-apart spirit. So now these are olives. It's a tree very much considered rooted in the land. And Yahweh here specifically says that, I am Yahweh, God of Israel. I think that's what he's speaking about in this second statement.
Mm-hmm.
Then moving on to the next statement, this would be Yashaiah 17:7. In that specific day, this man will genuinely regard and always accept the Almighty, his Maker, and his eyes will continually look towards God, the set-apart one of Israel. If you were to turn to Israel today and you were to interview 1 million of the 7 million or so Israelites that are living in Israel,
mm-hmm.
if they know, regard, and accept Yahweh as their Maker, if they look towards the set-apart one of Israel as their focus... And my guess is that if you were to interview 1 million of the 7 million, you would not find one.
We make this declaration?
Yeah.
No.
And that's why I think the numbers are, you know, 2 or 3, 4 or 5. We still have time. You know, things are going to get continually worse, and we're in 2017 now. Tribulation begins in 2026, so 9 years. Things will get worse over the next 9 years. And God is saying that 9, 10 years from now, there are going to be some people that take this stand, and it's only those that take this stand that make this acknowledgement that will be part of that gleaning. So the key to the gleaning is to genuinely regard and always accept the Almighty, our Maker, with our eyes continuously looking toward the God, the set-apart one of Israel. Now, that would preclude, by the way, all Christians and all Muslims and everybody else, because there isn't any Christian that looks at, would call, yeah, I serve the God of Israel. Not one. you know, Muslims want to destroy the God of Israel and Israel in the process, and most Christians are anti-Semitic. So, and what's also interesting is that the Orthodox Jews living in Israel, the Black Hats, the Shahs, they actually hate their country.
They hate their country.
Yeah, they won't fight for their country. They won't defend their country. They look at Israel as simply a means to bankroll their fixation on being religious. They want to be paid by the government to be
religious.
And they will not serve in any way. They don't want to pay any taxes. They don't want to contribute to the society in any way. They would never refer to God by name, much less look to what he conveyed in his Torah, nor refer to him as the set-apart one of Israel.
Let me throw in something that Terry and I were reading last night as we were celebrating Teruah, mm-hmm. from your translation on Yeshayah 56, 6 and 7.
Yeah.
And he's describing the children who are not Israel or not Yehudim, or don't know they are if they were, but foreign people. And he says the children from foreign nations who form a relationship with Yahweh, serving him and loving him, loving Yahweh, Yahweh's personal and proper name, who carefully observe and revere the Sabbath, do not treat it with contempt. Those who are passionate about and are empowered by my familial covenant relationship, these I will bring to my set-apart mountain, rejoicing in my home and tabernacle. Their offerings will rise up and be accepted, because my household will be called a house of intercession for all of these people. If you just read that first part of his personal name, because they love God, they accept his covenant relationship,
mm-hmm.
that doesn't describe it's sad. I mean, it's heartbreaking.
That describes less than 1,000 people on the planet.
Yeah.
And the vast preponderance of the 1,000 people, if that many, are part of this fellowship.
Yes.
There are less than 1,000 people that know and use Yahweh's name, that appreciate the terms and conditions of the covenant, accept the terms and conditions of the covenant, value the covenant above all else, who observe Yah's instructions, particularly the Shabbat, and understand what it represents.
Mm-hmm. And Moed Mikros,
yeah.
We celebrate what those, and it just is, we show up for the celebration. We show up to think about it. Thank you.
What you've just read describes the first fruits that he says he's going to harvest.
Yes.
And there are Yehudim, Israelites, that are part of the covenant family, that are part of our fellowship here.
Yeah. Well, as you said earlier today, he doesn't expect a whole lot of us, but he certainly expects this, and this is just the heart of what we do and what the heart of everyone I know as a covenant member loves, his name.
Correct.
His plan.
Yeah. Correct. Now, this is what he says next. And by the way, that's spectacular, which you just read, of course, reaffirms everything we have said thus far.
Yes, sir.
Clarifies it, affirms it, underscores it, clarifies it, all of those things. So then, speaking of those that God has chosen to glean, he shall never accept or gaze upon the altars, the religious sites for slaughter and sacrifice, these works representing what fingers have made. They will not focus upon the Asherah, nor the worship of sun god images.
A blow to the Christian world.
Oh, Asherah is Easter.
Yeah. A start day. Heaven.
Asherah is the basis of Easter Sunday. It's the basis of the Madonna and Child the Queen of Heaven, the Mother of God. And I understand there's some Protestants out there that don't worship Mary the way that Catholics do. But, you know, Catholics and Orthodox Christians collectively represent, 2 billion
mm-hmm.
of the 2.5 billion Christians today?
Yeah, it's 400,000 to 500,000 Protestants, yeah.
Yeah.
But, what is it?
Yeah. So when he talks about the Asherah, he's talking about 2.1 billion of the 2.5 billion Christians today. And then when he adds worship of sun god images, he gets all of them.
That's all of them.
That's all of them. Sunday worship.
Well, they all have the cross on
it. Easter, we're talking about the winter equinox and the winter solstice and the spring equinox.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about the cross as a sun god image, where the sun crosses Taurus the bull on the day where day and night are of equal length. Which sets the timing for Easter Sunday, named after the same god, Asherah.
And they all call him Lord.
The cross. The Lord is God. You're right. They all have a trinity. As a matter of fact, Church is named after the sun goddess, Circe.
Mm-hmm.
Every aspect of the religion.
They all kneel in
prayer. Yeah.
Peace the children. Bow down. Close your eyes.
Right. Every aspect of this is sun god imagery. The halos on the religious statues, the Christmas wreaths, Christmas itself, Easter, as we've stated. All of this is sun god oriented. Now you look at a church and look at all the sunbursts that there are in churches. They're everywhere, and all the dates pertaining to Christendom are sun god derived. So what he's saying is, Christianity, it's done. You know, well, there is a very small amount of sun god imagery within Judaism, but the only thing that I'm aware of really is their facet with two things. One is they still have a fascination with the Star of David, which is stars are suns. And second, they wear that the yarmulke on their head, the round disc, copying what the Greeks did, and that round disc represented the sun. So there's a couple of them, but when you're dealing with, there's no trace of Asherah and Asherah in the in rabbinic Judaism. But there sure as hell is in Christianity, even in Islam. Islam's not a sun god religion; it's a moon god religion.
Moon god, yeah.
Yeah.
Crescent moon.
Right.
Words.
So, you know, if you want to be part of this gleaning, then you're not going you're never going to look at anything to do with Asherah, which would be Christmas, Easter, Sunday worship, the Mother of God, Queen of Heaven, Madonna and Child, Virgin and Child, or anything to do with any sun god based religion, which is Christianity. Well, that's a powerful message for Teruah. If you're a Christian, mm-hmm. forget it.
You're out.
Okay. Yeah, you're excluded. Now, keep in mind that during this time, you've got Muslims running amok trying to destroy Israel, and they're going to be wiped out. Don't say, ha, 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 Christian. Because if you're a Muslim, you're in even worse shape. In that specific day, it shall come to be that the cities of his refuge and defensive fortifications shall be abandoned, like an occult presence in the thicket, as if drugged. And then the uppermost branch of the olive, therefore, shall be completely deserted for a time. Because of the presence of the children of Israel, then, appalling desolation and stupefying ruin will exist. I had just always stopped where there was a passage that refers to only one in three Yehuda are going to survive. And well, that's pretty bad. And I remember reading where it talks about women in Jerusalem are going to be raped, their homes are going to be burned, and many men will be killed. And, you know, that's bad. And the passages I've translated recently from Yashaya, God says specifically that only 1 in 10 are going to survive.
And that's a devastating number.
Yeah. And he was really insightful in terms of you know, I'm going to tell you, you're going to want to be part of this gleaning because not only are 9 out of 10 going to die, it's going to be hell on wheels. It's going to really be awful. And that's what God is saying here. On that specific day, the defensive fortifications of Israel are going to be abandoned. And the reason we abandon is that Muslims, by the hundreds of millions, are going to flood into Israel. Israel is vulnerable. God has said it's indefensible. And Muslims are going to all join in to the last jihad, hoping to earn direct entry into Allah's brothel and hell. And so things are going to be really bad. And it's going to be abandoned, and people are going to be running around like they're in a stupor. And the only the uppermost branch of the olive, therefore, remains, and it's going to be deserted for a period of time. There's a period of time where there won't be anyone on the planet who knows Yahweh.
I think that's happened before, though. I think that's been more. I think there's been more times in the history of that than we would know. But
I think there's a lot of. I don't think it's unprecedented,
but it's still bad.
It's not unprecedented. There's lots of times when there's nobody here.
Yeah,
nobody
lots of times when no one. And you know, and people say, "Oh, how's that even possible? That God would create humankind and no one would know Him." You know,
he left a written record.
You know, Yahweh's got a wonderful life. Yeah, he's got a wonderful life. You know, he's and he gets to celebrate it with Adam, who he loves, and with Abraham and Sarah, whom he loves, and Ishak and Jacob, whom he loves, and Dode, whom he loves, and the prophets that he has spoken through, and Moshe, who he dearly loves. He has got a wonderful family.
Yeah.
And he's in heaven. He's told us specifically that he's just going to withdraw from a long period of time. And so Yahweh's not witnessing this. He has removed himself. And for a very long period of time, there has been no one to work with on planet Earth. No one. Now, obviously, he has told us that his message would be conveyed and he would begin to work with individuals prior to his return, and we're part of that, and that. But one day we're going to be harvested, and when we're harvested, there won't be a single olive. Not one. Not a single person on the planet who knows Yahweh. And yes, I think that has been true for a lot of time in human history, but these last 7 years aren't an ordinary time in human history.
No.
This is an extraordinary time, and at Israel's darkest moment, no one will know God. So what that means is there has to be a survivable legacy. Now, the only legacy that Yahweh cares about is His Word. That's it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But there'll be no one who knows Him conveying His Word, which means there has to be a legacy, whether it's the YouTube videos that are posted, or the websites that that are posted, or printed copies. You know, how in the world Yahweh gets this message to?
It'll be a little of all of those.
Yeah,
it would only take a handful of people to take some of these books and stuff with them back Israel.
Yeah, you're right. That's correct. That's correct. Doesn't take a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yahweh can do a lot with one person.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah, I know a couple of people who have every year for Teruah, they print out a copy of the Teruah volume of Yada Yah and leave it out on their, you know, kind of as a symbolic thing, leave it out on the counter of their kitchen, and, if anything happens, read this, and you'll know why
right.
I'm not here.
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah. And now they're reaching one person. Right. Now they can hand it out someplace because they know we're going to continue to be here until this series of events. And I never did, by the way. Mm-hmm. That the conclusion we just came to that we don't have to. We no longer have to worry that Teruah could be fulfilled between now and that. God gave us the order of things. Teruah is going to be fulfilled after Damascus is destroyed and after Yisrael is spent at the waste. Mm-hmm. So we now know when it's going to occur, but that doesn't leave us a lot of time. It still only leaves us 9 or 10 years, so we still need to be focused and convey the Teruah message. So it's going to be completely deserted for a time because of the presence of the children of Yisrael. That appalling desolation and stupefying ruin will exist. That's why Yahweh has harvested his children. That's why he's called us home. He does not want us to witness appalling desolation and stupefying ruin. And, you know, when you consider how bad man has treated bad, how disgusting
how bad things are today, how bad does it have to be that he's going, I don't want you guys to even witness this, when you look at how bad things already are?
Yeah, if you look at how bad things are today, how bad they were and during World War II, World War One. Yeah, you look back at the U.S. Civil War and how bad they were. You know, you look back at in terms of the conditions throughout the Holy Roman Empire. By the way, you know, you even think about the Third Reich. You know, the first Roman attack on Israel was in 70 CE. The second Roman attack on Israel was in 133. The third was the Third Reich. Yeah. You know, the Third Reich was named after the Holy Roman Empire. Something to think about. But God is saying that this is going to be just stupefying, appalling desolation. And that's what's going to happen in Israel. And that's what it's going to take for his message to take root. Israel has to get to the point that they say, you know, I can't rely on the IDF. I can't rely on my superior intellect. I can't rely on my rabbi. I can't rely on America. I can't rely on anyone but my God. And I'm for damn sure I can't find my God in the Talmud. So I better turn to the Torah. We need to get reacquainted. And I think everything transpiring the way that he has forecast it is going to open some eyes. And in the midst of all of this, they're going to awaken. Indeed, because this is amazing. This is Yeshaya 17:10. Indeed, because you have completely ignored and you have actually forgotten, becoming totally ignorant of the God of your salvation and deliverance, and the rock of your protection and refuge. You do not remember nor mention the Most High. Therefore, you plant the Lord's vines, and you continually sow an illegitimate, unauthorized, and loathsome means to estrangement, via branch that needs to be pruned. That is the truth. No. Religious Jews and secular Jews have completely ignored and are completely and totally ignorant of the God of their salvation. They do not know Yahusha. They do not know Yahweh. They do not know his means to save them and for them to become part of his family. They are completely ignorant of these things. They have totally and completely replaced Yahweh and his message with rabbis and their message, or secular Jews with political Israel or secular socialist secular humanism. There is no room for the Most High. There is no room for Yahweh. They have completely forgotten Him. That's why they're in this mess. If they knew Him, if they trusted Him, if they observed what He had to say, then the Muslim jihadist would not be able to attack them, kill them, rape them, rob them. They're vulnerable because they've chosen to ignore the only source of their salvation and deliverance. That's it. And what are they doing now? They're planting the Lord's vines. The Lord is Satan's. You know, this term that is used here, Na Amanim, is an epithet for Adonis.
Mm-hmm.
It's from Adonai, means the Lord. A pleasant appearing, beautiful and desirable, misunderstood, pagan wound in the Garden of Adonis. Adonis, it means Lord, by the way. Therefore, you plan. And, you know, and it's interesting that they picked that Yahweh picked the Lord from, and that Adonis is named, of course, after Adonai. But Rabbinic Judaism? Rabbinic Judaism encapsulated enormous amounts of the Greek religion and Greek policy and Greek thinking. You know, that's that whole Maccabean period. So that's why it's, therefore, you plant the Lord's vines, and you continually sow an illegitimate and loathsome means to estrangement. And that is what Rabbinic Judaism is. It's a means to be estranged from the God whose name they won't even say. From a book that they tell everyone not to read. That you can't read the Torah. You need one of us to read it and explain it to you. But, of course, the rabbis don't read it either. They read the Talmud. Now, I'll tell you what, it is a branch that needs to be pruned. It's not a branch that is bearing fruit that's going to be harvested. It is a branch that that needs to be pruned. In that day, you raise your garden, and the early part of the day, your seed will bud and sprout, leaving a shaken and corrupt heap, which is piled up and will be thrust aside. In the daytime, there will be weakness, affliction, and tribulation, including the influence of incurable physical pain and mental anguish. Still through it all, they'll be sowing the seeds of destruction. And say, hey, look what we're producing, you know, and Israel will continue to produce its produce, but it's going to bud and sprout and then die. You know, one of the things that's interesting about Muslims is that if you study the Hadith, Muslims never worked. Never. The only job a Muslim has throughout the Hadith of the Quran is in jihad. Robbing and plundering others. They're parasitic. They do not work. And so as they flood into Yisrael, and we're told what happens in the 18th chapter, later here in the 17th and 18th chapter of them flooding into Israel, that's what's going to happen. And so they're going to continue to sow the seeds of discontent, and the consequence is that there's going to be tribulation. In the daytime, there will be tribulation, including the influence of incurable physical pain. That's why we're no longer here. This tribulation that occurs after we leave is going to be anguishing. Woe. Be wary of a great many nations, roaring in hordes of agitated terrorists, loudly groaning, similar to the seas. They will wail, and the roar of the societal chaos of the people of the nations will be like the horrible uproar of the waters. Intensely and in great numbers, they will collectively strive to desolate and lay waste. This speaks of a tsunami of jihadists.
Mm-hmm.
Of loud mouth, you know, the jihadists. Allahu Akbar! Allahu Akbar! Allah is greater, greater than whom? Yahweh. Roaring, agitated terrorists from a great many nations. Well, there are 50 Islamic majority nations, but there are Muslims that are going to come from virtually every nation on earth. So, whoa, be wary of people. Absolutely, it's the last jihad. Now, Muhammad made it clear that the only guaranteed way for a Muslim to enter the Islamic paradise is to die as a jihadist, killing Jews. Woe, be wary of a great many nations roaring and hordes of agitated terrorists, loudly groaning, similar to the seas. The seas, of course, is a reference to non-Jews, Gentiles, and the fact that they're roaring and loudly groaning, and they will wail, and the roar of the societal chaos. The people of these nations will be like the horrible uproar of the waters. God is painting you a picture here. If you're a Yisraelite, a Yehudim, Muslims, by the tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions, are going to flood into Israel. You don't have enough bullets to stop them. It's going to be a tsunami of Islamic jihadists. Why? Because you're ignorant of and did not trust, did not rely upon
Yahweh.
Yep. And so they're going to flood into the country. Literally a tsunami of terrorists. They were staged in Lebanon and Jordan. And the nations made you forfeit the West Bank. You're 7 miles wide at the waist. You were vulnerable. You were unsustainable, and the Muslims are going to do just what the Nazis did after Neville Chamberlain sacrificed the high ground of Czechoslovakia.
So you're telling me in the heart of Jerusalem, there's a building that's got Yeshayah's scroll 2,200 years old,
mm-hmm.
and it says this right there, and nobody's reading it. That just ain't right.
I'm
talking rhetorically, but that ain't right, man.
That ain't right.
It's right in your face.
What value is the IDF? What value is your nuclear arsenal? How are you going to use your nuclear arsenal when you're 7 miles wide,
throw yourself
where 70% of your people live? Do you think they make a nuclear bomb that you can constrain to that narrow a section of land? What good is your nuclear arsenal going to do? What good is your IDF going to do? What good are your jets and your bombers and your Iron Dome? What good is any of it when millions of Muslims are flooding in your country? And you can't get a peace by a two-state solution because God said it's the forfeiture of the West Bank that makes you vulnerable. You're going to have the two sets, not solution. And you're indefensible. This is what's going to happen. It's all laid out there. It was told 2,700 years ago that these Muslims are going to be like an uproar of the waters, intensely and in great numbers. They will continually strive to desolate and lay waste. You know, there aren't a lot of militants whose primary goal is to desolate and lay waste. But that is the agenda of Islamic jihadists.
And they want to capture it.
This is predicting now. This is inevitable. We're reading future history. This is going to happen in 2027 and 2028. Absolutely, unequivocally, it's there for you. If you're a Yisraelite, you ought to be listening. You need to be listening. This is what's going to happen. Be part of the gleaning. Don't endure this. Don't have your loved ones endure it. You could stop it collectively, Israel, if you just turned to Yahweh now, but you won't. You've forgotten him, and this is what's going to occur. And I don't think there's any more important story for us to tell of Teruah than this one. know, it's good that we expose and condemn Christianity. It's good that we expose and condemn Islam. It's good that we expose and condemn socialist secular humanism. But the thing that Yahweh most wants us to condemn are all of the human institutions that have collectively led his chosen people astray, and to tell them, you need to turn back to Yahweh. The ultimate purpose of Teruah, because that way Teruah leads to Yom Kippurim, the day of reconciliation, when he reconciles Yisrael and Yehudah into his family. That is what Yashayah 17 was written to accomplish. To tell Yisrael, this is what's going to happen. And unfortunately, this is what's going to take for you to experience Yom Kippurim the way that it was designed. Boy, it takes an awfully stubborn nation to choose to go through this, when all they had to do was pull out the playbook from Hezekiah.
Yeah. So that's exactly what I was thinking. Don't they ever read Hezekiah?
Yeah, just off the old Hezekiah account. What did he do? There were, you know, we're not talking about tens of millions of jihadists armed with all manner of American weapons at your doorstep, flooding in like a tsunami. There were 185,000 Assyrians, and yet Jerusalem had no defenses. And so rather than taking a normal approach, Yahweh said, Hezekiah said, why don't you show me again that copy of the Torah you found somewhere in a back corner of the temple? I think I need to read that. Nothing else has worked. Let's read that. You know, we're dark times. You know, they were about ready to be
destroyed.
Yeah, we need to find out what we're doing wrong here. And he read it, and the first thing he said is, oh, my God, we need to observe Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim, but we can't do that while our country is filled with these religious artifacts. So the first thing we got to do is get rid of the religious artifacts. Then he went to Yahweh and said, okay, we did that. But the Lowy are so lame-brained, they're so out of sync with what they were called to do, they don't have a clue as to how to help the people observe Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim. I need another couple of weeks. Yeah, could I have an extension of time so that we can get the Lowy up to speed so we can do this right?
That's a really cool story.
Okay.
Yeah, I need a couple of weeks before they invade.
Hold
on to invade for 2 weeks, would you?
But, yeah, that's by saying that the timing is a lot less important than doing it right. And then understanding what it represents. So that's fine. And then they got into celebrating. They forgot all about those Assyrians. They all, by the way, died, poisoned by the water that came out from underneath the springs. Poisoned by the water. They one of the few that survived went home with their tails between their legs. And Hezekiah and company, then without any of the religious trappings, with all of the religious buffoon silence, with the Lowy back up to speed, explaining what Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim represented, well, Hezekiah says, hey, yeah, we're really having a good time. This whole celebration thing and meeting with you is a lot of fun. How about we do it for another week? Yeah, okay, that's fine. Let's party for another week. What a marvelous story. That's all Israel has to do even today. But you can't celebrate these things as a historical event celebrating Israel's exodus from Egypt. You know, you need to understand that Pesach represents eternal life. And it's the doorway to life. And you need to understand that Matzah is about removing the fungus of religion. And that Bukurim is about being adopted, firstborn children into Yahweh's family. And they don't know that. They don't celebrate those days as such. They don't come to Yahweh. They don't approach his set-apart spirit. They don't know any of this. So we are really fortunate that we got to do this program on Teruah. We got to celebrate Teruah the way it was intended.
You think that's a coincidence?
No. I hope not. I don't think so. And I think particularly that to be able to do Teruah on Teruah with this program is particularly special. I know it is to me, because it was only 2 weeks ago that we came to realize that in Yeshaya 5, now 12 chapters before this, Yahweh called us out and said, "You're going to be my banner that I'm going to lift up. You're going to be the means that I use to awaken my children." So for him to mention us specifically and through it, the greatest of his prophets, and then for us to be able to do Teruah on Teruah, that is spectacular. I think what we're going to do next week is on this, the evening program, we'll return right to Yeshaya 5 as Yahweh is working his way to specifically calling us out. And I'm thrilled that we get to do this on Teruah after we've come to realize that after a very long period of time, there's been no one. That as feeble as defective as we may be,
in fact, we're the only ones willing.
That's right. We can take the may out of it. As defective as we are, but restored by the great physician, you know, as you say, maybe we're willing. Yeah, we're willing.
We're glad to have the willing.
Yeah, you know, when Yahweh said, "Who are we going to send? Who will walk with us?" He didn't specify, is there anybody qualified?
No.
Is there anybody in a position of influence? Is there any king out there? Is there any cleric? No. He just said, "Who should we send? So, who will walk with us?" So, by his own admission, the standards, the qualifications were nil. Other than you,
are you willing?
Yeah,
he can make up for that.
Do you know me? Are you willing to go do this?
Yeah, Yeshaya said it all. Behold, look, right here and now.
I'm listening.
I'm paying attention. So I'm listening. I'm paying attention. Right here and now. Send me. And then I just love Yahweh's statement. That's what we spent the program on last week. All right. If you want to go, you can go. But I want you to know this in advance, that you can tell them all day long that they ought to be observant. They ought to listen. But
your
not.
Words are going to fall on deaf ears.
That is correct.
Yeah, that's kind of what's happening now. But then,
yeah, and you need to know that. As long as you know that, I'm glad that you're going. I'm glad that you're going to do this. This is, you know, a good thing to do. But don't have any expectations. And by the way, I want it to be that way. I don't want them to know me. Because if they were to know me and do their normal thing and continue to blend a knowledge of me with their perverted religion, then I'm going to be demeaned and slandered.
I'm going to be made to look foolish.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's why I, for the initial reason, I wanted to separate from Unpopular Truth and later from Fred's group, is I don't like Yahweh being made to look foolish by an association with conspiracy and fake news. Yahweh doesn't want to be made to look foolish by an association with religion. So he says, I don't want him to know me. Well, I'll tell you what a wonderful way to celebrate Teruah.
Always.
Yeah, always.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And Kirk, send me, no hurry, but send me what you can work out on that. I'm continuing to make slow but sure progress through the symbolism of verses 17 on. You know, if you you get inspired and can deduce why he's using that symbolism, you know,
I'll go through all the words and see what I can find there. I'll dig out as much as I can.
Yeah, I'll continue to send you what I come up with, but all in all, that's there's a lot of work. You've already seen it. There's a lot of work that has already gone into it, and I'm quite certain that I'm a long way from understanding it. There's got to be a reason that he's using those particular metaphors. My initial sense was Yahweh wanted to say something that we would understand that would not be understood for the great duration of time. Because he has already said he doesn't want the religious to know him, because they'll intertwine him like America does with their religion and politics. They don't want, he doesn't want that to happen. So he said, you know, they can look all they want, but they're not going to see. So there's really the possibility that this was conveyed as symbolism to keep them from understanding, but then give us, now that we have all these marvelous tools, the opportunity to understand.
Mm-hmm.
So, methinks that's the reason what I've come up with for most of it so far makes sense, but boy, there's a lot that goes into this.
Yeah, I've only barely started, just a cursory read. When he's talking about butter and honey, isn't that more of because of their fleeing the cities?
Yeah, it could be.
Because it's a luxury food, but they're not eating good food. It's just that's something that you could take on the road with you.
Yeah, well, honey doesn't require any refrigeration, and it will
endure
for very long.
And then the butter is better. The Bedouin people were always, there was something I remember reading where they, you know, they actually were putting the milk in the things and it got hot, and therefore they were making curds. And so it's a lot of stuff in there.
Yeah, that word for curds is interesting, because it's curds, which is soured milk, butter, cheese, and cream can all rendered there, but it's from a root, or at least identified with the feminine version of the same word, which speaks of animosity. You know, because there's a verse where, you know, they're going to eat curds for curds or butter for butter, you know, and you have to say, okay, what does that mean? And you know, he's talking about cream, butter, curds, or is he drawing the distinction to animosity? And it's going to take some noodling to unravel this one. JB, I'll send it to you too. It's,
send that to me.
Yeah, I'm not. I'm right now in the midst of the 23rd verse. It goes through 25, but it's all extraordinarily symbolic and you know, I'm quite certain that I'm missing something here. All right.
But it'd be fun to look.
Okay, send me your thoughts anyway. Thank you, guys. Right. Happy to roll.
Happy to roll.
Talk to you next week,
JB.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.